It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about Governor Evers' proposal to legalize marijuana in Wisconsin and what the future for the drug could look like at the federal level under the Biden administration. First, federal health officials at the CDC have written that it is safe for children to, quote, maintain or return primarily or fully, end quote, to in-person instruction as long as safety precautions are followed. They conclude that school-related cases of COVID-19 have not significantly contributed to increased community transmission. But they do warn that some school-related activities and contact during sports has shown increased risk. We want to hear your thoughts on in-person learning right now at 800-642-1234. If you're a teacher or a parent, how do you weigh the pros and cons of going back to school? Do you think we should be going back to in-person school partly, fully? Is your district already in person? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. He's the author of the book Hitmakers and host of the podcast Crazy Genius. He wrote a piece called The Truth About Kids, School, and COVID-19. Derek, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Will you start your piece with a survey of the research looking at places where kids have been back in school? What kind of things can we glean from that?
Yeah, well, let me start by saying I know this is a very emotional topic. It is a confusing topic. It's emotional because it involves things that people care about a lot. It involves people's lives. This is a deadly disease. It involves people's children, involves their children's education, and it involves their own lives if they're a working parent or a parent that's had to stay at home for whatever reason because they are pulling double, if not triple, duty. So I know that the calls that we're going to get are going to be rightfully emotional. But what I tried to do here is cut through the data as best as I could see it, talk to experts, and review the studies that seem to have the greatest preponderance of evidence behind them. And the upshot of the data that I looked at goes something like this. Children, especially children under the age of 13 or 10, are less susceptible to infection. They are less likely to experience severe symptoms. They are far, far, far less likely to be hospitalized or die, even if they are infected. And they are also less likely to transmit the disease, even if they are infected. We know this not just because of one study in Ireland or another study in Singapore or another study in the US or another study in Norway or another study in South Korea or Israel. We know this, or we think we know this, because of studies in Ireland and Singapore and the US and Norway and South Korea and Israel. So at this point, I do think that the CDC is on solid ground when they write that the preponderance of available evidence from the last 6 months should reassure parents and reassure teachers that with adequate masking, distancing, and ventilation, the benefits of opening schools do outweigh the risks of keeping kids at home 4 months and months longer.
And can you talk about, before we dig into more of the health numbers, talk about the concerns that are real about at-home education, virtual education, and who might be being left behind by it?
Yeah, this is a great question. Look, I've been working from home for the last 11 months with my wife, who works in education. We don't have kids, so what you're about to hear is coming from reporting rather than from experience. But what we know, or what we think we know, seems to indicate that parents are unbelievably stressed, that children are facing real learning deficits that may outlast the pandemic itself. We know the remote learning has gutted some public schools, as a lot of high-income parents have pulled their kids into private schools. Calls to mental health hotlines have increased. There appears to be severe mental distress for children. And there is some sporadic indication that there's been clusters of student suicides. More indirectly, I think it's important to point out that the cost of school closures can't be measured exclusively by the loss of learning from those children. It spills over into other public health interventions. We've seen delays of immunization programs. We've seen interrupted free lunch programs. Whatever edifying effects of play researchers and sociologists have taught us exist for kids have clearly been eliminated by the inability for them to play together. So it is in balancing all of this information that I say not that schools are quote unquote safe. I'm not saying they are safe the same way that, say, talking on the telephone to a sibling or a friend who lives 2,000 miles away is absolutely safe. But rather that when we balance all of this evidence against what we seem to be seeing in terms of the risk of keeping kids at home for months, that I do agree with the CDC that it's time to redouble our efforts to return children to American classrooms.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic, he wrote about kids returning to schools to in-person education. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Now, Derek, you mentioned that the CDC talked about safer, at least with masks and with distance and with good ventilation. And there's some bright, shiny schools out there that could probably pull this off. I think of my kids' elementary school back in the day, the building's knocking on the door of 100 years old, retrofitted, some rooms too hot, some too cold. Sometimes there was hornets. There are some schools where it's going to be harder to pull this off safely with the kind of room for distance, with the good ventilation that we're hoping for, especially in the winter. Do you think it's going to, the results will vary, the decisions might vary depending on criteria like that?
Yeah, this is a really, really good point. And the answer is that there have been some studies in really cold climates that, you know, essentially found that transmission in these environments simply wasn't that high. There was a January 2021 paper from Norway where they traced more than 200 primary school children between the ages of 5 and 13. They didn't find any cases of secondary spread. That Norway paper reached the conclusion that children play a very limited role in the transmission of SARS-CoV-2 in school settings. There was another study in the fall and early winter out of Duke University that looked at several dozen North Carolina school districts that had in-person teaching, again, found no cases of child-to-adult spread in schools. That study also reached the conclusion that schools can reopen safely. This is a really emotional issue, and it's a very serious issue because, of course, we don't want to accelerate community spread in places where cases are running rampant. But once again, we are for now, fortunately, in a situation where in just the last month, COVID-related hospitalizations have plunged by 40%. COVID cases have plunged by, I believe, last time I checked, more than 50% in the last month. I do think that especially as vaccines start to increase, we are in a place where we can end remote learning, which doesn't appear to be working very well where it's been tried.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. In our household, we don't let anybody come into our household that has been basically exposed to anyone within the past 5 days. If all of a sudden all three of our kids have to go into school every day, although it is less risky than an adult going into that sort of situation, it still does add an increased level of risk that as a parent and as a household member, we're just not willing to take. So unless there's still a virtual option, we're kind of stuck in a point where do we pull our kids out and homeschool them? Because that might be our only option to maintain safety. We have people who are immune compromised in our household.
Tim, thanks for the call. Derek, even a set of small risks is a percentage increase in the at-home risk that Tim is not willing to tackle.
Yep. It's cases like Tim's, you know, that are the reason why I am not asking for every school to open up immediately, for every parent to send their kids back to school immediately, no matter what the circumstances are. I am here for really no other reason than to deliver my read, a careful read of the science, to pass along what I'm hearing from experts and to draw what I believe to be appropriate conclusions and implications. I think the direct answer to Tim's concern is that everything we know, I shouldn't say everything we know, the preponderance of evidence from research around the world seems to indicate that children under the age of 13 play a very, very, very small role in transmitting this disease. We're not exactly sure why that is. I can go into a little bit about the sort of physiology of this disease and ACE2, which is an enzyme that is underregulated or downregulated in young children's noses. So maybe they're less likely to catch more serious versions of this disease. We're not entirely sure why it is the case, but they just don't seem nearly as likely to transmit this disease as adults. And so it just is the case that when you weigh the risks that we're taking to students' socialization and long-term learning against the risk of them transmitting this disease, I do think that it, for most people, argues for returning kids to school as soon as we can.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're talking about his piece on schools and COVID-19 spread. He looked at a lot of the research that's come out over the last few months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should kids go back to in-person classes? Just some kids, maybe the younger ones or people with special needs. If you're a teacher, a parent, what are you worried about? What are you hoping to see happen? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you're involved with the school that's doing in-person education, what does it look like? Have things changed? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. He recently wrote a piece on the latest research on in-person school during COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and experiences. Let's go back to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi.
Thanks for talking with me. First, I want to thank Derek for sort of paring down all the volumes of information that we get all the time about what's safe and what's not safe. It's really overwhelming. So it's nice to have somebody put it all together for us in clear terms. And I also wanted to ask, what has been studied about the kids that are in between? I feel like there isn't too much information about the kids that are between 10 and 16.
Interesting, Derek. Thanks a lot. So yeah, over 16, they're more like adults when it comes to COVID. Under that age group, as you were saying earlier, much less like adults. How about, the tween zone, plus or minus?
This is a great question. I feel comfortable, given the people that I've spoken with and the research that I've looked at, saying that elementary schools fall under the category of schools that we should try to open as soon as possible, provided that we can give them masks, have a plan at those schools for some measure of social distancing and ventilation. Once you get to high school, I honestly think it's a little bit iffy. What we see with this disease overall is that the risk, not only of severe illness, but also hospitalization and fatalities, tends to increase really, really dramatically with age. That overall lesson seems to apply in terms of the difference between elementary schoolers and high schoolers. So my analysis, and I thank the caller for having me point this out and really be specific about this, is that in the plan to reopen schools, we should be reopening lower schools, daycares, elementary schools, given the demonstrated reduced transmission risk of young children before we start opening high schools.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Aaron next, calling from Green Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I am a public school teacher, so I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts, Derek. Thank you. I just wanted to bring up two things. So I'm a high school public school teacher. I work with very, very high needs kids, specifically teen parents. And I have had so many of them thrive in this online environment, because, they don't have to worry about daycare and things, which is great. And also, I work with students that are already dealing with mental health crises. So I have a lot of students that I feel wouldn't necessarily benefit from reopening the schools, because the mental health issues that they're dealing with right now are due to family economic stress, food insecurity, you know, like parents being laid off and things that opening the school is not necessarily going to fix. And while I definitely like desperately want my students back in my classroom, I'm afraid that this is going to be like that scapegoat where open the schools and then we send everybody back and then we say like, well, why are they still depressed? Why are they still anxious? And one of the trauma responses that we really need to notice is that when these kids come back, they are going to be anxious. They've been social distancing for how long? And now we're telling them that it's safe.
Erin, thanks a lot for the call. So Erin pointing toward mental health challenges for kids, among other things, because of the pandemic itself, apart from remote schooling, Derek.
Yeah, and she's talking about, you know, being a public high school teacher. Again, I'm not sure that my analysis applies to high schoolers. I left high schoolers out of the analysis that I published at The Atlantic. I don't feel as comfortable applying the research that's been done on younger children to older teenagers. I also think it's really important to say that, look, a lot of people are talking about how, oh, you know, school right now is broken and we have to get back to putting kids in school. Well, that sometimes feeds into this sense that everything before the pandemic was hunky-dory. It wasn't. Sometimes crises shine a light on what has been broken for years. And it's very possible that we're going to learn about different kind of hybrid education models that are much better for lots of different students. You know, maybe for, you know, students who are teenage parents or students who are dealing with mental health problems or students that are dealing with some other family problem that I can't even imagine at the moment. And that some kind of hybrid education is going to be a much better fit for their psychology, their life circumstance, their life. I think that's a really important point to have on the table. It gets a little bit beyond the scope of this article, which is really about the research about young children's transmission risk. But it's a fantastic point to bring up that even as difficult as this has been for so many people, we have probably learned better ways to work, better ways to teach, and better ways to learn in this pandemic that we should continue to sort of employ even after we achieve something like 75-80% vaccination in this country.
Thanks a lot for that call. And she mentioned the word scapegoat, Derek, and that reminds me, you are careful to point out in your piece, you're not blaming schools for the situation they're in. They got dealt a tough hand, no matter how you slice it here.
Yeah, I also think it's really important to point out that, you know, I think the government has just done a horrendous job for the last 11 months at public health communication. They have flip-flopped on issues as simple as should you wear a mask? It's gone from definitely don't wear a mask to wear a mask and now wear two masks. I think that's really confusing to people. People are so busy in their lives and so busy with the stress they're feeling from this pandemic. I think it's really important to make the most critical aspects of COVID-19 science as simple as possible. And I get that if I were like a teacher relying on information from the mainstream press or from the government to make a decision about whether or not I should, go back to school, especially if I'm, you know, in a pod that includes some immunocompromised relatives, I'd be pretty scared of returning. So I have a lot of sympathy for teachers, and I am not blaming teachers for keeping schools closed yet. I do blame the government first and foremost for its poor communication. But we're reaching a point now where the CDC has now said that it's looked at the preponderance of evidence, and it wants students to be back in school before that fall semester. So I really do hope that we can start to get this message out there that we do have a different understanding of the science of disease transmission than we had 9 months ago. And so we should act like it.
Let's take one more caller. Mike is with us in Slinger. Mike, hello.
Hey, guys. I got a question. I just heard a study on public radio a few days ago that a lot of people that are asymptomatic, and I'm assuming they're adults, even though they don't show any signs of having COVID-19, they're showing the damage to their lungs, to their arteries, and even to their heart from the virus itself. And my question is, have there been any studies on children? And you're talking about elementary children.
I got you, Mike. Your call's breaking up, but I think we got the gist. Derek, Mike concerned about adults having damage, even when they're asymptomatic from COVID-19. Is there any kind of look at that for kids?
I've written an article about the long-term effects of COVID, sometimes called long COVID, on young adults, on people in their 20s and 30s. It's a really serious thing, and I think the science is clear on that. At the same time, though, what we're talking about here are young children. And what the research says is that young children aren't just less susceptible to infection, they're also far less likely to experience any severe physiological symptoms and certainly far less likely to be hospitalized or die. And then again, of course, I think they're less likely to transmit the disease to adults. And so it's you putting it all together, I think that the risk of this disease to children is just not similar to the risk of this disease for the adults that the caller very rightly said can experience physiological symptoms of this disease even if they feel like they're asymptomatic.
Thanks for that call. Derek, we focus on kids. There are grown-ups in schools. One concern I heard early on is that for substitute teachers, a lot of them are retired teachers, older and in at-risk groups. Schools worried about the staffing, given that some of their staff, the key staff, would be at risk. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do think it's fair to say that the risk of contracting COVID-19 in school is far more likely to come from a fellow teacher than it is from a student. And that's why I think, you know, schools need a plan if they're going to reopen so that you aren't creating a scenario where a bunch of unmasked teachers are spending 15 minutes together in an unventilated room every single day. That is an absolute risk. But if you can plan so that that doesn't happen, if you can enforce masks, if you can enforce a bit of social distancing, especially between adults, I really do think that you can open up a lot of schools that are currently closed and have a lot of children that are currently at their homes and their apartments and houses to go to schools.
Derek, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. We've been talking about a piece he wrote called The Truth About Kids, Schools, and COVID-19. He rounds up a lot of the data that's out there from schools around the world. Governor Tony Evers announced marijuana legalization would be part of his new annual budget that he's proposing this month. The proposal would have to be approved in the legislature, which looks like a tall order. President Biden is also expected to try to change the federal approach when it comes to marijuana. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think marijuana should be legalized in Wisconsin at the national level? Do you support legal medical use only but not recreational? Do you support both or neither? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Hudak is deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book Marijuana, A Short History. John, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back.
Well, I want to read a little bit from Governor Evers' statement here. Quote, legalizing and taxing marijuana in Wisconsin, just like we do already with alcohol, ensures a controlled market and safe product are available for both recreational and medicinal users and can open the door for countless opportunities for us to reinvest in our communities and create a more equitable state. End quote there. John, what are your thoughts on now the governor of Wisconsin making the case for legalized recreational and medicinal marijuana?
I think Governor Evers is really reflecting the policy views of a majority of Americans. A majority of Americans are done with the drug war. They're done with prohibitionist policies on cannabis, and they're ready to move on to something that's more sensible, that's regulated, that generates safer products, and as the governor mentioned, generates at least some level of tax revenue.
Now, Wisconsin is a bit of an outlier in the Midwest and around the country with not allowing any form of legalization. Can you talk about the trends we've seen at the state level?
Sure. So at the state level, since 1996, we've now seen 36 states come online with really full-fledged medical cannabis systems. Most recent being just in the past couple of years, just in the past year, actually, in Mississippi. Since 2012, we've now seen 15 states and the District of Columbia come online with full-fledged adult-use cannabis systems. And this reflects real changes that have happened in public policy, both among the mass public, but also changes that have happened in public opinion within legislatures. Legislators now in a lot of states, including the latest Virginia, which passed legislation last week to legalize, are seeing drug policy in a very different way. And even if the Wisconsin legislature isn't there yet, it appears that Governor Evers is.
The legislature, some Republicans in the legislature have talked about medical marijuana as a possibility. Recreational, though, seems unlikely. We talked to Republican State Senator Van Wongard from Racine about police reform bills earlier this month here on Central Time. The topic of marijuana legalization came up. He said he didn't support it, called a gateway marijuana a gateway to other bad stuff. Here's some of what he had to say.
We have learned with some of the studies that have been done, and there's some really lengthy studies that have been done, over a 20 or 30 year period, that they found that marijuana, as an example, is not something that helps somebody. It causes psychosis and it causes a lot of schizophrenia, et cetera. And so to add that, so now we have more people out there like that, we make it okay. I sure won't want my grandchildren to be indulging in that with the potential of them having psychotic episodes, et cetera. That makes absolutely no sense. I mean, this was the thought when they brought oxycodone and those things in, and people used that and ate all that stuff like it was candy. That's what's gotten us to the point where we're at now. So creating more of it, making it legal for more, that is not going to help us become a better society, in my view.
Republican State Senator Van Wongard there. He also raised concerns about marijuana being tainted with PCP or fentanyl. This is a significant, a prominent Republican lawmaker here in Wisconsin raising his concerns about legalization. John, what do you think?
I think this senator needs to do quite a bit more reading and certainly some more modern reading than he's used to. The reality is this. Cannabis exists in all the communities in Wisconsin already. Legalizing it is not going to introduce the substance to the state. The research that exists out there that the senator is trying to reference does not connect cannabis with psychotic episodes in its users. There's much more complicated science that he's glossing over there. Any comments that you had in your question about cannabis being a gateway drug has been long, proven to be false. And so I think rhetoric like that is dangerous. It's misinformation and disinformation. And, you know, I hope that Wisconsinites will at least do some of their own research, especially because it appears they can't, rely on their state elected officials to give them the right information.
Talking to John Hudak from the Brookings Institution, author of Marijuana, A Short History, talking about a proposal from the governor to legalize recreational marijuana and medicinal in the state. Coming up, we'll talk about possible changes at the federal level, too. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Tim?
Thanks for having me on. Hi. I just wanted to make some quick notes. Here in Wisconsin, in 1908, we began growing hemp for the first time in Madison. And we quickly became the nation's top producer. In 1920, we had four counties that produced more hemp than the rest of the nation combined. Anyway, if we legalize marijuana, we could have a closed-loop economy where we had growers, everything from the growers to the shops, all in within the same community. And I don't know when Republicans were against civil liberties of people and the opportunity to make some tax dollars.
Tim, thanks for the call. Now, hemp is legal to grow. There are pilot projects around Wisconsin. That's a non-psychoactive version of the product, I think. But Tim, John, raising the potential economic benefits there.
Yeah, Tim's right. The systems that have popped up in the United States, legal either for medical use and or adult use, they are closed loop systems. We don't tolerate in the United States the transport across state lines of cannabis. We do some with hemp, but in the states that have legalized, these systems are closed loop. So what you grow, what you process, and what you sell all have to happen within the state. And so it does create an economic benefit. And so beyond the tax revenue that comes in, we know that the cannabis industry creates legal jobs. We know that it creates economic activity, and that it also has spillover effects into other industries that then help serve the cannabis industry. And so the economic effects of legalization should not be measured solely in tax revenue. But like Tim said in his question, the economic driver really happens in the private sector.
Before we go back to our callers, thanks for calling in, Tim. I wanted to ask about what's going on at the federal level. I know when President Trump came into office, there were concerns, especially with Attorney General, then Attorney General Sessions, that the federal government would crack down on the states that had legalized some version of medicinal or recreational marijuana. That didn't end up happening. What are people looking at? What are you looking at with the Biden administration now?
Yeah, you're right. When Jeff Sessions came into office, about a year after he came into office, he passed a memo, issued a memorandum that essentially reversed an Obama-era policy that was a hands-off approach for federal prosecutors in legal states. What ultimately happened was that federal prosecutors ignored that guidance from Attorney General Sessions and essentially kept up the Obama-era process that was in place. And that, of course, continues today. I think with the Biden administration, there's real hope that some form of cannabis reform happens. It appears that national level legalization is not something that the president supports, but there's a lot of distance between prohibition and full-scale legalization. There's a lot of policy changes that can happen with regards to banking, law enforcement, criminal justice reform, et cetera. And I think we're in a moment right now where, rightly, the conversation about cannabis reform is getting entwined with the conversation around race and social justice and criminal justice, because they are intimately related. And as that moves forward, I think a lot of Americans are seeing the issue of drug policy as one that's inherently steeped in issues of race and justice. And I think the administration sees that too. And so my guess is that the administration doesn't fully know what its position is going to be with regard to cannabis reform, but it's likely going to look very different than all of President Biden's predecessors.
We're talking to John Hudak from the Brookings Institution, author of the book Marijuana, A Short History, looking at the possibility of recreational and medicinal marijuana legalization here in the state after a proposal from Governor Evers, and things that could change at the federal level at two. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think about legalization. What questions do you have? What concerns or what hopes do you have? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with John Hudak, Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, looking at the future of medicinal and recreational marijuana here in Wisconsin and at the national level. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the issue. We'll go back to your calls now. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Jeremy, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am in favor of full legalization for both recreational and medicinal purposes. Reason being, people are already consuming cannabis on a daily basis, and the means in which they go about getting that cannabis is on the streets. You never know what they're getting, and you never understand. It could be laced, it could be tainted with other things. You never know. And there's a crime element involved with street value cannabis, and it needs to be brought out of the darkness and into the light. People are self-medicating themselves with cannabis, and they may be buying cannabis that has nothing to do that could possibly help them with their medical problems, but they're at the whims of whatever is available on the streets. By bringing it, legalizing it, you are offering them a more variety of cannabis for medicinal purposes as well, and it's very important that they do that. It'll free up law enforcement running around chasing after people with marijuana and allow them to use those resources to things that are a little bit more important than what I believe is narcotics, heroin, things like that.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for the call. John, Jeremy's saying safer and will allow us to pursue better public safety priorities.
Yeah, Jeremy's making the type of arguments that tend to connect with a lot of voters in a lot of states, and I assume Wisconsin will be one of them. The tax revenue argument gets put out there a lot, especially by elected officials, but the reality is the tax revenue ends up not being a huge amount. Governor Evers projected about $165 million a year. That's probably about right from what I've seen in other states, but that's a drop in the bucket for Wisconsin's budget. But the reality is the idea of having a safe, regulated product coming from a trusted source, the products being tested, The composition of those products being known to the consumer is just something you don't get on the black market. And like Jeremy said, people are self-medicating, or they're using products recreationally that they just don't really know what's in them. That doesn't happen in a regulated market. You mentioned earlier, you had comments earlier from a state senator who was talking about the adulteration of cannabis, having fentanyl and other products in there. Now, those stories tend to get blown up and largely come out of nowhere or come from very, very rare cases. But where they don't come from is a legal regulated market. You don't have a professional licensed cannabis grower in the state of Nevada or the state of Colorado sprinkling fentanyl into their vape pens or into their flower. It just doesn't happen. Those activities can happen on the black market. And like Jeremy said, there's crime associated with the black market. Some people sell cannabis and they sell a lot of other things other than cannabis. And so trying to intrude on that market and trying to displace that black market into a legal market is something that I think a lot of Americans are looking for as a policy path forward.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Joel on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel says he's a retired anesthesiologist. He writes, I'm not sure why legalizing another mind-altering drug, which allows people to escape or avoid reality, is a good idea. Joel goes on, I know that heavy users undergo significant changes in their tolerance to medications, especially anesthetic drugs such as propofol. So the claims that THC is harmless or totally benign are demonstrably false. Joel also raises concerns about driving under the influence. We have enough problems with alcohol. So not completely harm-free, Joel says, John.
No, I mean, Joel's 100% right. Anyone who tells you that cannabis is harm-free is lying to you. Anyone who tells you that cannabis cannot lead to what we'd call cannabis use disorder or an addiction is lying to you. That happens. And a market needs to be responsible. And people need to make better decisions. And people making those better decisions can happen through consumer education. It can happen through conversations at the point of sale. And I think if you are going to legalize cannabis and not take the steps to try to minimize those public health and public safety issues, driving under the influence, as Joel said, is another one, you're doing it wrong. But the states that have moved forward with legalization, we haven't seen long-term spikes in driving under the influence or driving-related fatalities. We have in a couple of states seen them very early on, and then that number dropped back to more normal ranges or back to the pre-legalization number. But we need to be able to address those public health issues. And one of the best ways that we address public health issues is by diverting tax revenue to those sources, to the types of programs that can deal with that. Right now, in a state like Wisconsin, you're not extracting any tax revenue out of the sale and distribution of cannabis because it's illegal. By legalizing it, you can get your hands on more of that revenue and direct them to the places where you are concerned that these issues might pop up. Driving under the influence of cannabis, cannabis use disorder are already problems in the state of Wisconsin that the state government cannot use cannabis resources to direct to. Under a legalization program, they can.
Talking to John Hudak from the Brookings Institution about marijuana legalization. Back to your calls now. Ethan is with us in Janesville. Ethan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think a previous caller kind of touched on it with the state representative claiming that fentanyl and PCP are going to be somehow more of a risk under a regulated system. Thanks for talking about that. Not terribly harmful, but still a little harmful. I appreciate the conversation you're having. I'll let you go. Thanks.
All right, Ethan, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. We'll go to Kylie now in Sparta. Kylie, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kylie?
So there's actually two things I'd like to bring up. My issues, I am not for this. And two reasons why. First being that they're trying to legalize something because a lot of people are already doing it illegally. And I don't feel like we should cater to people who break the law already. The law's in place, and just because more people are doing it and are breaking the law doesn't mean we should change the law necessarily. Okay. And then my other problem with that is somewhat tied with that is that I see it as a gateway drug in that it's the mindset of those people who will break the law as the law is right now. And that leads to them breaking laws in other ways because the law is not what they follow.
Kylie, thanks for the call, John.
So I'll start with the second point about it being a gateway drug to bad behaviors. There are certainly cannabis users in this country who also engage in other, activities that are against the law, in the same way that alcohol users do, in the same way that people who drive Buicks do. There's a lot of people who engage in a lot of activities that they shouldn't. There's also a lot of cannabis users who don't. The idea that because you are unwilling to follow the state's cannabis laws means that you have no respect for the rule of law at all is a very, very difficult point to try to demonstrate. And really, the data just do not bear that out. On Kylie's first point about legalize something simply because people are already doing it, I generally agree with that. I think that because something is popular does not mean that it's a good public policy idea. Because people are already doing it does not mean it's a good public policy idea. But part of that conversation, too, around cannabis reform also has to look at the root of cannabis laws and the ways in which cannabis laws are enforced. And what we know is that the root of cannabis laws have been steeped in really awful racist policies in the United States, and that the enforcement of our cannabis laws also has very challenging racial issues with them. So, for example, in the United States, we know that white Americans and non-white Americans use cannabis at about the same rate. But Black Americans are almost four times as likely to be arrested for a cannabis crime than a white American is. And so we know there's racial discrimination in the ways that these laws are enforced. And I think in a perfect world, we would have our laws enforced with some equity, but we don't. And so what these laws end up doing, even though, you know, a lot of people are already using cannabis in states around the country, Wisconsin included, is that these laws are a secondary means to discriminate against groups of individuals. And I think we really need to look at the enforcement of our laws and not just the laws themselves when we think about weighing the costs and benefits of them being on the books. And when we get to that point, I think it does begin to get into an area where we start to question whether cannabis prohibition is actually worth it and what kinds of effects it's having on communities across Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. And John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was John Hudak from the Brookings Institution. He's the author of Marijuana, A Short History. He joined us for a look at the future of marijuana legalization at the state and federal levels.